Welcome to the Essential Southern Podcast, where we explore the rich history, culture, and traditions of the American South.
Welcome to the Essential Southern Podcast, sponsored by the Abbeville Institute. Go to www.abbevilleinstitute.org, A-B-B-E-V-I-L-L-E-Institute.org, and help us explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition. All right, so let's talk about the topic of this Essential Southern Podcast, and it is the arts, in many ways, poetry. In fact, that's the title of the piece we're going to talk about today. It is titled, The Southern Poet and His Tradition, and it was written by Donald Davidson in 1932. Now, if you don't know anything about Donald Davidson, he was one of the fugitive agrarians. He had contributed to the book I'll Take My Stand and later Who Owns America. For years, he wrote not only literature, of course, his Lee in the Mountains is considered one of the best poems any Southerner ever produced. Even NPR recognizes Davidson as being an essential part of Southern culture. But he was also a critic. He was a critic of the arts, a political critic. And this piece has all of that wrapped up in it. And it is a discussion of tradition. Now, oftentimes Southerners are focused, and particularly in the modern age, on politics. They want to understand how to confront the political problems which are facing America today. Whether it's which side you agree with, it doesn't really matter. We look at things in political terms. Davidson was concerned with culture. And as long as you have a society of leisure, you can have culture. And in fact, he brings that up here. Now, you can have different various forms of government, but as long as you have leisure, culture can exist. And so for many of the Southerners interested in this particular part of the tradition, the artistic side of it, the political side needed to reflect the culture, needed to reflect the tradition. But these traditions could exist as long as there was leisure. And in fact, Davidson brings that up in this essay. It's really interesting how he winds that into the arguments of exploring a much more robust Southern poetry tradition. I mean, the title is A Southern Poet and His Tradition. So it's about 10 pages. It's an interesting article. We're going to go through it. So let's get started. He says, 10 years ago, we were reviewing Carolina Chanson's, the editor of poetry, saw it in the joint work of DuBose Hayward and Harvey Allen, the promise of a new articulateness for the South. The South had a heroic past. It was rich with legend and fierce with feeling. There was no perceptible reason, Miss Monroe thought, why Mr. Hayward and other Southerners, then beginning to write, should not make the fullest possible use of the material at hand. Out of the Southern tradition, there ought to grow an exciting, possibly a really great Southern poetry, which would be a considerable ornament to American letters. Now, the South as a distinct region, the South as a distinct people, the South with a heroic past, right? Rich with legend and fierce with feeling. These are essential ingredients for a robust literary tradition. So this was in 1922 that this review was written. And you think about that. Davidson had ruminated about this for 10 years. He thought about these things. Well, what does this actually mean? What can we do with this? This charge that we need a new Southern poetry, that we can have this resurgence, this renaissance. And that's often what this period is called, the Southern Literary Renaissance, when you get to the 1920s and 30s. We can have this renaissance, and the South can be the focus, the focal point of that movement. He says, at the time, I was one of a group of poets in Nashville, Tennessee, who, though committed to the idea of a distinctly Southern poetry, could not accept Miss Monroe's doctrine. We felt that it was dangerous to prescribe any special subject matter for the new Southern poets, and it was dangerous to tie them up with the sort of local color program that Miss Monroe's remarks seemed to imply. In the columns of The Fugitive, then just getting underway, we said as much, and said it with a defiant bellicosity that was quite wasted. If it had been noticed, it might have reminded observers that the picturesque charm of the Carolina Lowcountry was one thing, but the pugnaciousness of the Western South, still half horse, half alligator, and ready to fight all comers, was another thing. So comparing the two, you have this charge to have this new Southern poetry, and Davison is saying, we resisted this. And if you had paid attention, the Carolina Lowcountry had a certain charm to it, but the frontier, the Western South, was half horse, half alligator, was pugnacious, ready to fight, charged up. Maybe there was something too. These regional distinctiveness, even in the South itself, these regional distinctions, I should say, even in the South itself, maybe there was something to all of that. Now, the fugitives have been criticized for being too interested in the frontier South, the Western South, and too critical of the old tidewater regions of the South, the Low Country, the old South. Because, well, they miss something when they do that. But it does show you the diversity in the South. And I think that Davison is recognizing that, well, there's something to this. There's something to this call. There's something that's bigger than what we realized. We were young and brash, and we didn't really know what we were doing, because we couldn't see the beauty of what was being asked of us. And when you talk about things that are part of the tradition and things that you need to do, this is something that's important. And so if you're a writer, if you're a musician, if you're an artist, if you believe in these things, take the lessons that this particular piece has to offer to heart, particularly in the 21st century. Davidson said, it is not my task to say whether the Southern poets in the 10 years since Carolina Chasins have fulfilled Miss Monroe's hope. Mr. Hayward, to be sure, seems to have abandoned poetry. The poetry renaissance of the South is less ebullient than it was in 1922. The Poetry Society of South Carolina, surely the finest organization of its kind in existence, probably finds itself in the embarrassing position of wondering where the poets have gone whom it is pledged to foster. I can only imagine what these people would say now about our literary societies. What kind of material is being produced? I mean, there's some good material still being produced, but has it fallen off to a point where you're wondering, particularly with the modern laziness and the lack of a real culture in America? I mean, we've gotten to a point where consumerism has driven us all into the suburbs and away from any kind of muse that would allow us to express these kind of things. I mean, not for everyone. I mean, we see it every now and then, but even the things that we find great, and I'll give you an example, the Richmond North of Richmond, right? The Richmond North of Richmond, Oliver Anthony, which isn't his name, but we gravitated to that particular song because it had an authenticity to it. But how much of modern music is inauthentic? And even that song, would it have been that popular, say, 50 years ago, because you had these other things already? I mean, it was Hank Williams Jr., but because we haven't heard that since the late 1970s and early 1980s, you know, 40 years ago, wasn't that interesting? I mean, it would have just been another thing back then. But now, there's something to it. So Davis has said, it is time to state Miss Monroe's proposition again, though in slightly different terms. After all, it is a fair question to ask why Southern poets, as artists with a very special local heritage, cannot write like Southerners. Why is that? And this is a really interesting question, because we have this now. We're all the Southerners who are writing Southern things. Why can't Southerners write like Southerners? Davidson's critique here is spot on. rather than like advanced Parisians or Greenwich villagers, and why they cannot, among other things, write about the indubitably Southern themes, even the Southern legends, places, heroes. Though that alone, of course, will not make them Southern poets, or in fact, poets of any sort. Why can't these people write about the things in the South? At least he's writing this in 1932. What's happened to America? What's happened to the South? What's happened to the artists? Yet this, it seems, is precisely what many of them cannot do, or cannot without falling into grievous error. A young poet emerging in the South today is in danger of following one of two courses, both of which are bad. In one case, he will utterly divorce himself from all sense of locality and at once begin to write clever but trifling imitations of decadent poetisters in New York, London, and Paris. But if he is safely illiterate and so manages to escape the infection of our times, he may then write Southern poetry containing very proper local references, and this is sure to be as empty as the other was clever. So, look what he said. If he's a literate man, he's going to try to emulate all these Northerners. If he's illiterate, he's going to write Southern poetry, but it's going to be bad. So we don't have the literate Southerner writing about the South. We have illiterate Southerners writing about the South, but he's saying this is bad poetry. It's not very good stuff. Now, this is Davidson being the elitist, the literary critic, but he's on to something. You have to have the training, or at least the literary chops, to engage in these kind of things. But you have to have the awareness to produce good Southern material, is what he's saying. You have to put both together. If you don't, you're going to get two bad things. That's his argument. One tendency gives us modernists of every type, people who begin by grandly renouncing their birthright and by contributing to Woolly Messiah magazines of the blues or contempo variety. I mean, think about all the Southerners that do this, even to this day. The other tendency begets local laureates, cheerful infants who commit monstrosities such as state songs on the model of Catherine LeBate's America the Beautiful. The other begets local laureates, cheerful infants who don't really know what they're doing. But that, I mean, they produce things that people like, but they're no good, he's saying. This happens too often not to be emphasized as a phenomenon of our times. It can be traced out of a considerable scale in such as an anthology as Mr. Addison Hibbard's The Lyric South. It appears, though to a less horrifying degree, in the work of some of our best poets. It almost amounts to this: that a poet cannot be Southern without behaving like a fool. And if he tries not to be a fool, he will not be recognizably Southern. So, again, what he's calling for here, and people can get offended by this. Well, I mean, he's criticizing the South. He's saying, look, no, there's great stuff here, but we have to understand how to do it right. Again, there's an elitism to this. He doesn't like all these local yokels writing stuff that doesn't really sound very good, or it's not, I mean, it's just amateur. And you look at these songs that have been produced. Catherine LeBate's America the Beautiful. You look at this stuff, and it's just, eh. Or the Lyric South. It's not very good. So we need to put the two together. We need to get the Southerner who is actually literate to recognize that he has to have a charge or a responsibility, and more importantly, to write something that's good about the region where he calls home. But the malady, if it is such, is not limited to the poets. It may be found in a far more virulent degree among Southern writers of fiction, some of whom have occupied themselves with no little success and getting out Yankee novels about the virtues of the downtrodden black man and the vices of the depraved white man in the South. Ooh, now he just said something that, of course, is going to be picked up on as being, non-woke or PC nowadays, right? He's saying, well, I mean, these are the kind of things you get. And this is true. I mean, you look at the stuff that Southerners produce. So it's a critique of the section that is I mean, is it really a critique of the section, or is it just pandering to a northern view of what the South is? He says, I should be the last to decry the excellence that the better of these writers display, but it is evident that the attitudes underlying their work are too often borrowed from the progressive North and do not belong in the conservative South. You're pandering to the North. You're just saying, okay, well, we're going to write something that Northerners would like, that shows the South what it is. And you could say this. This is one critique of someone like Mark Twain. He wrote novels that Northerners would like. And there are a lot of Southerners that do this. They write novels, even to this day, that they think Northerners are going to like. They're going to be critical of the parts of the South that they think people are going to say, oh, yes, that's great. We like what you're saying about this. And Davis is saying that's the progressive North, not the conservative South. What are we doing? He says they should not be blamed too harshly, though. In America, or at least in the progressive America, which has been most vocal in recent years, every man who starts out to be an artist is subjected to a subtle but powerful pressure to emancipate himself from his native surroundings. If he is born in Keokuk and wants to do serious writing, his first act must be to either run away from Keokuk or somehow disclaim it. His craft does not come to him as part of a generally diffuse tradition which has local roots and which he naturally appropriates to as his own. No. He must get out and grab what he can from the set of rapidly shifting formulas spawned from the disorder of a delocalized, vaguely cosmopolitan society masquerading rather noisily as a civilization. Now, this is a firm critique of America and what it is. I mean, the progressive North essentially has ruined America. You want to talk about what America, why people are critical of America, he's saying it's the North. The North won. I was talking to a colleague the other day, and this is something that people miss. I mean, if you want to see what happened when the North won, just look at America. The South had no control over any of this. And Southerners recognize it. Northerners recognize it. He's saying, look, we're not living in an America that we control. This is an America we don't control. And the things that we do are produced by the America in which we live. What is America? It's a delocalized, vaguely cosmopolitan society masquerading rather noisily as a civilization. What does this society, loudly proclaiming its devotion to culture and the good life, have to teach the artist? To judge from the evidence, it teaches contempt, suspicion, disillusionment. It has no positive standards to offer, rather than a maudlin apostrophe to beauty, and no loyalist to anything nearer at hand than a somewhat tenuous world soul. It has nothing. It teaches contempt, suspicion, disillusionment. He's writing this in 1932. Just go on any type of medium in America, anything, where you have writing, art, and look at what they produce. Contempt, suspicion, disillusionment. Nothing positive. Nothing beautiful. If I may use the words of one of his popular prophets, Everett Dean Martin, it says to the artists, as to all civilized persons, it is nobler to doubt than to believe, for to doubt is often to take sides with fact against oneself. The skeptical, at cross purposes, tendency of our society was never better epitomized than in this amazing, and I would say damnable, utterance. Whatever it may mean for the scientists, this pronouncement offers a lamentable prospect for the poet, who must believe or perish. It is no wonder that our artists believe nothing, or by a natural reaction they turn in and believe too much, trying vainly to rebuild a personal mythology of some kind as a substitute for the tradition that the worshippers of doubt have destroyed. I mean, what a stinging critique of modernity in America. But it's a beautiful critique because he's pointing out in 1932 the problems with modern American society and the industrial world. He's going to get into that. But the consumerism that's driving that is not allowing people, artists, to flourish. because of these beliefs, these attitudes foisted on them by a progressive North. In other words, you have to reject progress, the notion of progress. It's at the core of everything. But in a way, it's not a progress that would be manageable or natural, because you can't have that. I mean, you think about farming. There's a progress to it. You plow the field, you plant the seeds, you tend to it, you water it, you cultivate it, you weed it, and it grows. That's progress. There's a natural progress to these things. Family life, all of these things are that way. And then there's artificial progress, which is what is created in modernity. Social progress, or all these other things that we call progress. I'm saying those are artificial. They're not really there. They're a fake type of progress. Material progress. What does that mean? I mean, we can say that we're more comfortable. But does that produce any kind of real progress other than material? And that's his question. So he says, Southern writers share this malady along with American writers in general, but one nevertheless feels that they ought not to share as much as they do. For Southern society is not yet American society. Not yet, he's saying in 32, but I think there's not much difference between them now. And this is the problem. I mean, if you're trying to explore what is true and valuable in the Southern tradition, and you're looking at what the two offer, well, there's not a whole lot of difference anymore. You still find it here and there, particularly in the real parts of the South that haven't been infected with as much Northern progressivism, but it's much more difficult to find. While the North has been changing its apparatus of civilizations every 10 years or so, this being, I fear, the peculiar curse inherited from that restless, haunted soul Abraham Lincoln, the South has stood its ground at a fairly safe distance and happily remains some 40 or 50 years behind the times. Can you say that statement now? This is 1932. So he's saying in 1932, we're still living in the 1880s. Maybe the 1890s. That's where we are in the South in terms of modernity. That was the charge of I'll Take My Stand. Let's not lose that lag. But the South is pushing ahead just like everything else now. And he's saying the North keeps changing, right? It's changing its apparatus of civilization every 10 years. This is because of Abraham Lincoln. I mean, you can't say that now either. Having once got a hold of an idea, even though it be not quite a perfect idea, the South does not hasten to discard it, but keeps holding on. The South has never been able to understand how the North, in its astonishing quest for perfection, can junk an entire system of ideas almost overnight and start on another one, which is newer but no better than the first. This is one of the principal differences out of many real differences between the sections. It is perhaps the reason why the South is not America the Menace. Look at what he just said there, right? It's discarding, it just keeps churning new ideas. Well, this is bad. I mean, and people can't keep up with this. It's dizzying. And you start to see it consume itself. If you just look at the Wokies and what they're doing, they consume themselves. And the South is saying, well, we don't just discard things like that. I mean, we try to hang on to stuff a little longer than you do. One would expect that Southern writers would be responsive to this stable tradition. The South ought to have an artistic tradition to fit its social and historical background. One ought to be able to say of it, as A.E. said of Ireland, that it is a good field for the arts, especially for poetry, simply because, in contrast to progressive America, it has long been defeated and poor and behind the times. Or furthermore, because it offers its people belief rather than doubt, conviction rather than skepticism, loyalty rather than distrust. Look at those traits. Belief rather than doubt, conviction rather than skepticism, loyalty rather than distrust. There's another word for that. Confidence. Confidence. There ought to be something virile and positive in its arts, as an art linked by devotion to a concrete place rather than animated by a loose enthusiasm for a national culture which has no organic unity behind it. For instance, if a Southerner had written John Brown's body, one would have expected to find the subject treated with more conviction and finality than Stephen Vincent Benet, writing somewhat remotely, could put into it. So Southerners would even have improved on that, right? It would have had something else to it, more conviction and finality. Because it has a concrete thing. It's not just some national amorphous culture, which has no meaning at all. You have to have a people in a place. This is why this essay is so good. Turning to the literary past, I find the evidence on this point rather confused and not too comforting. I should hardly join with those determined rebels who would defend Southern literature at any cost against the aspersions of Yankee critics. So he's not going to be uncritical of the South and Southern literature. Say it's great because it's Southern. He's not going to do that. And he hasn't. And he's made that clear at the beginning of this essay. On the other hand, he says, I should disclaim any agreement with those very fashionable critics, among them a few Southerners, who have been issuing passionate and contemptuous repudiations of the supposedly sentimental literature of the Old South. The literature of the Old South is neither as good nor as bad as partisans have represented it to be. Vernon Lewis Parrington, at least, has proved that the South shared with the West the dignity of producing a more respectable body of literature than the New England Brahmins ever used to allow. The poetry of the Old South and of the postbellum South had the virtues and defects of American poetry in general. It was romantic, or it was Victorian, with some sporadic excellence, but with no concerted and general achievement such as existed in New England. In the South, there are Poe and Lanier, set off against Emerson and Whitman. There are martyr poets like Timrod, Hayne, Russell, Pinckney, or even the newly discovered Chivers. There are also the folk singers, whose value is now only being realized. These anonymous poets, makers of ballads, songs, and spirituals, were and are abundant in the South to a degree which other sections can hardly claim. Now that is an important point. He's pointing out music. This is where, as another scholar at the Abbeville, Tom Daniel, says, the South wins. And I think Davidson was on to it here. So we've got the poets, but we've got the bards. The folk singers, he's calling them. The makers of ballads, songs, and spirituals. The anonymous poets. And that should be cultivated. It, on the whole, might well say with John Crow Ransom that the arts of the South in times past took another direction than poetry. They were the 18th century arts of dress, conversation, manners, or I might add, of architecture, handicraft, oratory, anecdote, all respectable enough and sufficiently recorded to the credit of the South. They were the arts of leisure. You have to have the leisure to produce the other, but they focus exclusively on the leisure and not the written art. So John Crow Ransom said, we had the arts. It was that. There is no reason to think that these arts did not express a Southern tradition rather intimately and without any fumbling or debate. Indeed, the problem of the relation of the Southern artist to his tradition did not then arise in its modern form. They didn't think about this. They had this tradition. They had these things that the South was good at, and they didn't need the other stuff. Now the arts have taken a different turn. Now, however, it has arisen, and the issues it raises are acute. If the South is destined, as so many people are saying, to be articulate on a scale never before realized, it will be a strange trick of fate for writers to find themselves at such a moment inhibited from a free expression of the Southern tradition, unable to speak for the South as a living historic entity, which is separate from America, though bound to it, and still abiding to a marked degree by the tenets of a civilization so thoroughly un-American in the modern sense, that it is in one breath romantically admired and the next breath harshly deplored by the much interested North. So how are we going to do this, right? We have this strange twist of fate. The Southern tradition can't really speak as an entity when it's admired and then deplored. You can't do it. So you can't really worry about the North. You have to just worry about the South. You have to write about the South for Southerners, not for Northerners. Forget them. Yet such is the danger that threatens. Those well-wishers like Miss Monroe, who are rightly eager to see a Southern poetry arise which is recognizably Southern, and not merely a somewhat tropical version of Sandburg, Robinson, or Eliot, those critics must recognize that there is civil strife within the South itself, and because of this, civil strife, the peculiar dilemma of the American artist described above, becomes deeply accented. And how uneasily so, I'm sorry. Left undisturbed, the Southern tradition would undoubtedly register effectively in art. But it has not been left undisturbed. Instead, the so-called Southern liberal group, who have of late grown much in power, aided by Northern philanthropy and by agitation in Northern journals, have bent every energy to persuade the South to make over its civilization on the progressive Northern plan, largely through the combined agencies of sweeping industrialization and a large-scale liberalized scheme of public education. The effect of this program has undoubtedly been to dislocate many Southern writers from a proper relation to their own people and their own tradition. As studied, for example, in such a center of progressive agitation as the University of North Carolina, the program will reveal, on the one hand, a determined effort to encourage young Southern writers to be spokesmen for their own section, to produce a modern literature expressive of the South. So far, so good. This would be laudable, indeed, were it all. So look at what's happening at UNC. On the one hand, we're saying, go out and be Southern writers. This would be great, he said, if that were all. But what we've got is industrialized mass public education, and that's what we're trying to produce. But there is also the social program that underlies and accompanies the program for the encouragement of the arts. This social program is not naive at all. It is foreign to the ideas that are most deeply rooted in the Southern experience and the Southern temperament. It involves a repudiation not only of the Southern past, but of the elements of the Southern character that are most firmly ingrained. The progressive leaders, in short, are asking the Southern writer to pay a terrible price for his modernity. They are asking contradictory things, and with such influences beating upon them, Southern artists will escape distortion only by being uncommonly level-headed and discerning. You can't be hotheads. You can't have the Southern hothead mentality and fit with the South. Fit with this modern conception of what it needs to be. You can't be Southern in this Northern view of the South. You have to be Southern so you have to write Northern literature with a twang. What has country music become? It's Northern music with a twang. Or at least a different kind of thing. It's not as recognizably, distinctively Southern. It just has a twang to it. It's adopted some things that you may not recognize outside the South. As long as such a condition endures, the Southern artists who are affected will do their work under the handicap of a painful self-consciousness. Theirs will be the dilemma of the modern artist who in one act must both deny himself and express himself. He concludes by saying there is no remedy short of the rise to power of a body of Southern writers, economists, politicians, and clergy who will fight to a finish the new order of carpetbaggers and scalawags or else assimilate with them. There's no remedy to this. You have to fight these people. Southern writers, economists, politicians, and clergy. It's going to take everybody. This is why this essay is so important when we're thinking about what to do, right? But even this remedy has much peril for the arts, which do not profit much by contentiousness. It is certain, however, that the well-wishers for the South cannot with one gesture uplift the South into the blessings of modern civilization, and with another demand of Southern writers that they exhibit in their works the virtues of a way of life that they have just been urged to repudiate. Yet if there is hope, and I think there is much hope, in view of the extraordinary confusion into which industrial civilization has got itself, the poets are likely to go further than other writers toward realizing the ideal of a free expression of the Southern character in literature. For the poets are unpopular. The poets are never promoted. The poets are unpopular. They're never promoted. They escape the commercial taint that hangs over novelists and playwrights. The poets are pure. They don't sell anything. They can just be poets. Think about what money has done to the bards, to the musicians. It's changed it. This is, again, you go back to Oliver Anthony, Richmond, North of Richmond. It was authentic. Once you throw in money, it's going to change it. It's not authentic anymore. The poets are unpopular. They're never going to have mass collections, you know, make millions of dollars on their literature. That's not going to happen. So they have the opportunity to critique and do things that are important and write their real literature. Let them write what they will, depending on their own integrity for a guide. And if they live like the Miller of D, envying nobody, and with nobody envying them, they need not fear that their integrity will be impugned or spoiled. Beautiful charge at the end of this essay. And this is why, again, I wanted to bring this up in this podcast and talk about this, because he's writing this in 32, and it's a charge. It's a request for the poets to write what the South is. Now, is it too late? We're nearly 100 years on from this. Is it too late? This is 90 years ago. 92 years ago. Is it too late? Has this South been erased that he's talking about in 32? Is it gone? Or can it come back? Or is it still there? I mean, who knows? These are big questions. So, hope you enjoyed this episode of the Essential Southern Podcast. See you next time for the next one. See you then.